Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The process of crafting a balanced budget for the next fiscal year is already underway. But State Treasurer Ken Simpler wants to look beyond the coming year for long-term answers to persistent budget issues.
And our current budget framework doesn't have any built-in sort of idea of what is a sustainable rate of growth that we can live at, that meets our means and our needs.
We chat with State Treasurer Ken Simpler about forging what he calls a grand bargain on the state budget. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We'll also take a closer look at the issue of human trafficking in the first state and learn more about Delaware's own John Dickinson, the penman of the revolution in History Matters. Plus, in this week's Enlighten Me, some holiday gift ideas you can get from local artisans. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. State Treasurer Ken Simpler was elected in 2014. The former hedge fund manager became the first non-incumbent Republican to win statewide since 1994, and he's currently running for re-election. He's also taken an active role in speaking about the state's recent budget issues and is advocating for what he calls a grand bargain. He says lawmakers from both parties should come together to overhaul the state's budget process and create more predictability and sustainability. Simpler is part of the panel lawmakers set up earlier this year, examining creation of a fund which could limit budget growth and help in economic downturns. Delaware Public Media political reporter Sarah Mueller recently sat down with Simpler to discuss his grand bargain idea and more.
Grand bargain, one, it was a term of art that's been used before in political circumstances, most recently when President Obama and then Speaker of the House John Boehner were trying to reach a bargain around reforming our federal tax revenues and reaching accord around the debt ceiling and some other things, and it was a term that was sort of popularized around then. You know, when I use the term here in Delaware, it is around two things. It's around getting our portfolio revenues some long-term reform of those so they're not as volatile, so they're more responsive to economic growth, more predictable, and that ideally they're as conducive as they can be to economic development. That would be large-scale long-term revenue reform. That would be part one of the grand bargain. Part two, or the piece that I think pulls it together and makes it work, is also on the sort of spending side of the budget equation. So it's what is it that makes the trend of spending, not the level, because there's lots of fights over how much or how little. That's not what the grand bargain's about. It's not about how much spending or how little spending. It's about how fast can spending grow. It's a different, so there's level and there's trend. And our current budget framework doesn't have any built-in sort of idea of what is a sustainable rate of growth that we can live at, that meets our means and our needs. So if you can sort of combine true revenue reform of our portfolio and spending disciplines long-term sustainable, I think you can get a political consensus that puts us in a place where we can get to what the most important issue is, and that is sufficiency or value.
So are you not talking about cutting spending, or you're talking about reducing the growth of spending?
I'm talking about neither cutting nor increasing spending, nor am I talking about necessarily lowering the current rate of growth that we're in. What I'm talking about is defining a set of economic parameters. Those could be growth in our overall economy as measured by gross state product. That could be growth in our economy as measured by our aggregate personal incomes. It could be measures of inflation. You know, that tell us what price levels are rising at and our population growth. Effectively, you took a basket of economic indicators. You could say these are measures of our needs as well as our means. These tell us as a people how much our resources are, what rate our resources are growing at and what rate our needs are growing at as a people. If we could harness our budget growth to that, we would at least know that over the long term, we are on a path, a glide path, if you will, that's sustainable. That's not part of our current budget architecture. So that's both, I mean, when people say, hey, when I say discipline, I also mean, to me, sustainability is not just about a ceiling, it's about a floor as well. It's about an agreed upon level that we know meets our needs and is within our means.
To balance the budget, you would have to increase revenue and cut spending. If you were in charge, you know, what would you do?
So here, the two things you have to understand about the budgeting process today that makes it more chaotic than it needs to, and the grand bargain really does, I'm going to introduce three words that I think if people take away from this, they'll understand what I think we're trying to get at. One thing that a good finance system does is it generates certainty, okay? If we have a test like we have today every year that says 98% plus cash on hand, that's what you get to spend. Well, let's face it, our revenue portfolio moves around with the economy. So any given year, what we can spend is going to be a function of what we take in, which means it's not going to be a nice level stream in the current thing. It's going to bounce around. If our revenue portfolio, the way we actually harvest the taxes that are on the revenue basis that we tax, whether it's personal incomes or corporate, if the way we put our tax scheme on top of that revenue base is it actually exaggerates the volatility, which it does, because we take a narrow stream of it. We take the top of the stream if we rely on more. So you're going to get movement every year just bouncing around. That in and of itself is a massive level of distraction, because in the General Assembly, a 1% or 2% shortfall is massive. But 1% or 2% based on a volatile set of revenue portfolios is going to happen almost every year. So our current system already sets us up for failure, because we spend the entire legislative session either trying to figure out, okay, we got 2% more than we thought, or we got 2% less, and how do we fix that? So one thing that the grand bargain does is it says, let's go back to that sort of test that says, let's combine these economic measures so we spend on a curve that's equal to our means and our needs. And guess what? That is very predictable. It's not bouncing around, because you blend these things all together, and what you end up with is 3% or 3.5% or somewhere that's, you know, a livable level of growth every year, and it's very predictable. It's much less volatile. That in and of itself, that certainty allows the General Assembly to basically plan for the long term. We can't plan for the long term right now. Agencies' budgets could be cut. Agencies' budget could be increased. Nonprofits could be cut. Nonprofits could be increased. That's a hard way to take on long-term challenges. All of the energy gets sucked into just year to year, trying to make a little bit of room in the budget one way or another. So smooth it out is number one. Certainty also applies over an economic cycle. What we know, what we've lived through, I'm 50 years old, I've lived through, I think, 5 economic cycles. The economy tends to go up, it reaches a peak, it pops, it contracts, it goes to a trough. Our test allows us to spend effectively 100% all along that time period. So in good times, we just ride the curve up, and then we're supposed to ride the curve down. We can't do that in state government. All those expenses that we buy into on the way up become fixed. We hire people that we can't terminate. We increase salaries. We rent space or buy space. We commit to long-term contracts. We borrow debt. So most of our spending is inflexible. So when you hit that peak and you start contracting, your only choice is to try to trim around the edges and find other sources of revenue. Well, you could have just as easily harvested the revenue in the good time. So our spending, you know, if the average is 3%, why do we live with a budget that allows us to be up 9% one year, down 6% the next, up 2% the next, flat the next? And that's the course of history in just the last 8 years of the Markell administration. So we have these wild swings that if we just had a system of smoothing out, one, by having a more predictable metric that we're following, but two, during the course of economic cycle, harvest the excess revenue in the good time above what that long-term trajectory is, park it away, draw it back in the bad times. That's not part of our current budget architecture. Let me give you one second word. The second word is sustainability. Sustainability is the fact that our current budget test doesn't tell us if we're on a path that is, in fact, within our means over the long term and how it's connected to our needs. It allows us to spend whatever we find. So imagine you in your personal world where you go along and you have a salary, and then one year you win the lottery. Would you spend 100% of the winnings and assume that you're going to get the lottery next year? I mean, maybe, but I mean, most people wouldn't say, hey, my base level budget is now 10x what it was last year. But our test effectively allows us to pick up these sources of income that sometimes do occur. We have abandoned property. We have casino revenues. We have things that have been explosive over the past that aren't even sourced from Delaware, we don't even control, that have had exceedingly rapid growth, and we've spent 100% of them.
So taking and saving the revenue that you get in good times and using it in bad times sounds like what a rainy day fund does.
Exactly what people might think it is, but we've had a rainy day fund, a budget reserve account, for 40 years. And when I'm 50 years old, I've seen probably 5 economic cycles or more. How many times do you think in that 40-year period we've used the rainy day fund? Never, because the rainy day fund is not actually built to articulate that it is there to do two things. If we had a real budget smoothing account, it would say two things. Hey, this account is to be used when we have that ordinary bouncing around. You know, every year it might be up a little bit, 1% or down 2%. You know, if we're on a steady curve of what we think is going to be around 3%, we're still going to bounce around it a little bit. Just no way to take all the noise out of it. That's the nature of the economy, right? But if it's fairly predictable to begin with, and if we have a smoothing account over here on the side, then we can just even out those little 1% or 2% changes from year to year. Second, it would have to say that, though. That's not what our budget reserve account says. Second, it would have to say this is really being built to handle an economic cycle. We know that instead of just being an average of 3% over 10 years, we're going to get explosive growth at the front end of this thing that's in advance in excess of that. And eventually, it's going to pop and it's going to come down and we're going to have negative growth. And over the course of the whole thing, we know it's going to be 3%. So let's just sit at 3% and harvest all those revenues. Our current budget reserve account is not drafted that way. It doesn't have a constitutional purpose that's clear to our legislature. The people that have been in our legislature, and some of them have been there 40 years, a handful, some have been there 30 years, they really view the budget reserve account as no one knows what it's there for. They know that it is part of our budget architecture, and they fear that if we use it, then we would be downgraded by rating agencies because they would think we didn't have the means to meet our needs. They worry that it's there for something like I'm not being facetious, but I mean like a meteorite striking Delaware, right? Something really unexpected, but it has never been used to meet our needs when we hit really hard economic times. And if you think about it, what you really want a smoothing account for in hard times is because the economy's tanking. When the economy is going down, the last thing you really want government doing is doing the same thing, cutting back and potentially, you know, exacerbating the downturn. What you'd really like to know is your government has put aside the money to finance itself and meet service level needs during that time, so it stabilizes the economy. And, you know, Delaware spends up roughly $10 billion flow through the state treasury. It's almost 15% of our economy. So it's not a trivial amount that if government is able to stabilize its operations, and let's remember, we provide the most basic stuff, right? Education, procure health care, roads and infrastructure, safety, security. Like, if we can maintain our ship through these turbulent economic cycles, it's going to help the private economy recover a lot more quickly.
Grand bargain, named after President Obama and his attempt to get this grand bargain with Republican leaders in Congress, didn't succeed. I know that in Illinois, they tried a grand bargain, which also, you know, failed. You know, they spent like 3 years trying to do it. Do you think that it's realistic to think that there could be a grand bargain?
Yeah, because I think those bargains, if you look back at them, were about the levels of revenue or the levels of debt or the levels of spending, right? And that's an issue we have to get through. I said two words earlier, certainty and sustainability. That's what this grand bargain's about. The third rail that's difficult, that's politically challenging for us to reach consensus on sometimes, is what I would call sufficiency. Are we spending enough? Are we spending too little? Our grand bargain is around certainty and around sustainability. Not the level of spending, but the trend we're on. If we confine it to those points initially, I think you can get political consensus around that, okay? Because when you talk to, whether it's Democrats, Republicans, conservative progressives, no one benefits to the chaos. No one. And they realize that the chaos that we create in state government has reverberations into our private economy. You know, when we go to July 3rd with our budget and surprise people about who's getting taxed now or who was getting taxed, or we tell nonprofits we're going to zero out your budget, or we, you know, brewers and realtors and everyone else has no idea what their economic picture looks like, you know, I came for a lifetime in the private sector. One reason I came to state government is because to try to rectify some of this uncertainty. I mean, people don't take risk when they feel uncertain. People take risk and they expand and they grow things when they feel comfortable and when they believe there's at least some level of certainty to their future. So if we can comport ourselves in a more certain way in state government and send that signal that we're not going to surprise you, it has a very positive reverberation to the private sector economy. If we can come together and say the growth rate that we can agree to is measurable, it's outside our control, it's dictated by what the economy is doing over time, and it's fairly predictable, if you can get the concepts agreed to of sustainability and certainty, then you actually can come back at a later date. That's our grand bargain, right? That differentiates it from other grand bargains. You can come back after that and then start to say, hey, in education, are we spending enough? Are we spending too little?
Have you gotten members of the state legislature to buy into this concept?
I was a proponent of the piece of legislation that was passed in the last session that established a new panel to study over the course of this, between July 3rd when we ended the budget and before the legislature comes back into office. We have had three meetings of an advisory panel that's composed of four legislators, one from each caucus, that's composed of our highest financial officers in the state, myself, Secretary of Finance, the Budget Director, Controller General, members of the public. And we have looked at what other states have done around these issues. You know, I use the term grand bargain. They may not have called that in other states where they put budget smoothing accounts into place and reinvented their fiscal controls. That's the term of art they use for what they deem to be a sustainable path. But other states after the Great Recession have reacted to, like, the difficulty of managing through that challenge and have taken some of these actions. We've also got the Pew Foundation, which is a nonprofit group working with us that has advised several other states and giving us advice around what they recommend based on Delaware's particulars. Because you just can't, this is not a off-the-shelf product. You really have to look at your revenue portfolio, your service level needs. You have to look at what your structural imbalances are, let's say, between those. If healthcare is growing at twice the rate of what your revenues are, you got a problem, right? But there's a toolkit that's going to help us, if we implement it, using the work of this advisory panel, to do the things we spoke about, certainty, sustainability, and ultimately sufficiency, and to make recommendations that hopefully they come out of this panel are either bipartisan or nonpartisan, however you want to look at it, and that have a lot of thought leaders behind it. So those are the recommendations of the advisory panel that I'm on, that we hope to make some at least initial recommendations to the governor and the General Assembly immediately upon their return. And our hope is, I believe, to try to have a final report before the end of the first calendar quarter so they can really act upon it in the next legislative session.
Thanks to State Treasurer Ken Simpler and our Sarah Mueller for their time on The Green this week. And stay with us. We'll take a closer look at the issue of human trafficking in Delaware when The Green continues. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Human trafficking is a crime that often goes unreported. It can be difficult for law enforcement to make a case, and oftentimes other charges more likely to yield a conviction are pursued. Delaware's League of Women Voters recently sponsored a panel discussion in Sussex County to shed some light on this $150 billion worldwide industry and its prevalence in the first state. Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino was there.
It's a Saturday morning. State law enforcement, representatives from nonprofits, university professors, and victim services workers sit on a panel before a full room at a community center in Harrington. The topic is human trafficking, the harboring or recruitment of a person for a commercial sex act. Yolanda Slaybaugh is among the speakers. She is founder and CEO of Zoe Ministries, a Greenwood-based nonprofit. She says human trafficking is modern-day slavery and points out it exists in all 50 states and occurs often in Delaware because of the state's location along the I-95 corridor.
Specifically coming down from New York, and because we're such a small state, it's very easy for traffickers to traffic their victims from New York through Pennsylvania or Jersey, Delaware, Maryland, and make a pretty quick escape back outside of our Delaware borders.
Slaybaugh says human trafficking can occur at residential brothels, truck stops, or hotels and motels. During her presentation, she displays an internet search yielding 84 advertisements for brothels in Delaware, fronting as massage parlors. She says traffickers often target society's most vulnerable, including runaway or homeless youth.
Oftentimes, they're running away from abuse. And so what happens is their psyche then has been trained to believe that the person that will take care of them will also abuse them. So when they're running away from the abuse and they run into the hands of a predator or a pimp or a trafficker, they've already been trained that whoever's going to take care of me is going to abuse me.
Traffickers often have strong psychological control over their victims, perhaps through a perceived romantic relationship, a series of lies or blackmail, or control over a victim's drug addiction. Delaware State Police Major Daniel Meadows says that's why victims are often hesitant to cooperate with law enforcement when a case is being made against their trafficker. He says this can make bringing in human trafficking charges difficult.
I think one of the greatest challenges for moving forward with a human trafficking case is the small window we have as law enforcement professionals in establishing trust and open communication with a potential human trafficking victim. The human trafficker exercises a great deal of control over those that they traffic.
Meadows says a 2014 law creating harsher penalties for offenders and better protections for victims has helped, along with better training. State Police Director of Victim Services Deborah Reed says law enforcement agencies are becoming more victim-centered in sex trafficking and prostitution cases.
They are now looking at the trauma. They're looking at, you know, what has happened in this person's life that brought them to this situation. And so I think the more education we have, the more knowledge we have, it makes us more able to recognize the victimization that's involved in a lot of these crimes.
And other steps are being taken across the state. Wilmington University is offering courses on the subject, as well as setting up training programs for hotel workers to recognize the signs of people being held against their will. Delaware-based nonprofits like Meet Me at the Well are working to educate and give a fresh start to women sold into sex trafficking. And though it would require additional funding, Yolanda Slaybaugh's group, Zoe Ministries, is advocating for long-term housing for victims of human sex trafficking.
We can have the greatest trauma therapy. We can have fantastic trauma-informed case management. We can have fantastic drug detox and substance abuse programs, mental health programs. But no matter how good our case management is, if that individual does not have safe housing long-term, none of those other services really matter.
Slaybaugh is trying to build a partnership with the Salvation Army and local Rotary clubs to create a long-term housing system in Delaware. She expects the Rotary to shift its focus to its human trafficking platform after the completion of its work with the polio vaccine next year. For Delaware Public Media, I'm Nick Shalino.
Thanks, Nick. And stay with us. This month's History Matters is up next. It takes us to the John Dickinson Plantation to discuss the state's effort to highlight a key anniversary in the life of the penman of the Revolution. But first, a look at your local headlines from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. It was 250 years ago that letters from a farmer in Pennsylvania to the inhabitants of the British colonies were published. These series of 12 letters appeared throughout the winter of 1768 in colonial newspapers, laying out the colony's common cause against the British Crown and Parliament in an effort to create a message to rally around. The man behind those letters, simply signed a farmer, was John Dickinson, a well-educated lawyer with Quaker beliefs who called Kent County, then part of Pennsylvania, his home. For this work, Dickinson would earn the title Penman of the Revolution. To mark the letter's 250th anniversary, the state of Delaware has created a website about them and John Dickinson, de.gov/John Dickinson, and will offer a variety of Dickinson-related events and programs over the coming months. In this month's History Matters, produced in conjunction with the Delaware Historical Society, I visited the John Dickinson Plantation just south of Dover to chat with Verdi Lee, historic interpreter at the plantation, and Doug Dennison from the Department of State about Dickinson, his letters, and the state's plans to celebrate the anniversary of those letters' publication. Verdi, we'll start with you. And I guess for those who aren't familiar with the Dickinson letters, can you give us kind of a thumbnail sketch of what they were about and what their overall message was?
Sure. The letters from a Pennsylvania farmer were published in 1767. December 2nd, I think, is the first one. And what they did was to really bring together unity among the colonies to talk about resistance, in a sense, to the Townsend Acts. So in a nutshell, what they did was they Dickinson gave the really the colony's response to the Townsend Acts, which were a way of raising revenue, but without representation from the colonies. So Dickinson, in a sense, wrote why it was illegal what Parliament was doing, and also wrote a response of the suspension of the New York legislature. So the New York Assembly was suspended as one of these Townsend Acts. And so Dickinson wrote about why this was illegal and why this was a threat, not only for, at that time, not only for New York, but for all the colonies.
And in some ways, I guess it was the beginning of the basis of the concept of taxation without representation being something of a rallying cry as the colonies started to resist the British Crown and Parliament.
So taxation without representation goes all the way back to 1764, which was with the Sugar Acts. So it was something that the colonies, and specifically John Dickinson, had been thinking about. He was part of not only the response to the Sugar Acts, but also he was part of the Stamp Act Congress. So he was part of the protest against the Stamp Act. So the last part was the Townsend Acts, and the Townsend Acts had, in a sense, not the same type of response as the Stamp Act or the Sugar Act. And he was almost mystified where there wasn't such a great response. So the letters from the Pennsylvania farmer really emphasized why this was a threat to all the colonies, not just in New York, but why this was an attack on all of us.
And to put it in some context, I mean, this was not really a point in time where there was a lot of consensus in the colonies on all of these issues. It wasn't these letters weren't preaching to the choir. They were really kind of trying to pull together a lot of people with very disparate views.
Exactly. That is exactly what happened. So Dickinson was able to write as a voice to unify the colonies. So up until this point, you have to think, we have separate assemblies. We don't have the same currency. We don't have any type of operating singular government except for the British Parliament. And what the Parliament did was, in a sense, impact all the colonies. And so Dickinson is writing to really unify the response. And these series of letters were so well read, not only in the colonies, but also in Britain and in France. And he had such a following because of it. So Dickinson is known as the penman of the revolution because of how he unified the colonies in their resistance to these acts. It's interesting because there's several different quotes that he uses, and he really talks about that being one of the strengths, really, is to be united and not to allow someone to divide us.
You kind of intimated the response to this. What was the general response within the colonies to these letters?
So he became almost a superstar. He was one of the first really well-known colonists in America. He was probably second only to Benjamin Franklin. So, and it continued all the way through the Revolution and even after the Revolution. Now, Dickinson has a bit of controversy because he did not sign the Declaration of Independence. He abstained from the vote. Yet this man who abstained from the vote marches against the British with his the next day. So Dickinson is a complicated man who's not easy to put into a box. And part of what we do here at the plantation is to talk about who he was and what his lasting legacy was. So Dickinson was, this is the beginning of his career. This is the beginning of how he becomes a voice for what eventually becomes the United States of America. And so many of his thoughts and his philosophies are embedded into what we see today as Americans.
Tell us a little bit more about what his role was after these letters and through the Revolution and into the founding of the country.
So Dickinson, up until 1775, is probably one of the leading voices of what is going on and to really give a sense to the colonists what is happening. Then what happens is we start to march towards war. So Dickinson tries to reason that we might still be able to adapt a constitution within the British system. But Dickinson, by 1776, is no longer really, Dickinson at that point realizes that we are about to go towards war. And Dickinson is worried about this prospect because Dickinson has also at this point become the drafter, one of the drafters, one of the first people to draft the Articles of Confederation. So he knows that we have no common currency. We have truly no defense in a sense that we are still trying to, we have no foreign allies, and we are not in the best position to go against Britain. And he worries that there is going to be much bloodshed, much destruction, and we will be brought back under the British after this annihilation as a country. So Dickinson is worried about this prospect. But what he does is interesting because he, on that fateful day, he does not vote against the Declaration of Independence. He's representing Pennsylvania. And at that point, he decides to abstain from the vote so that it carries forward as a united voice. And then literally the next day goes to march to defend his country. So it's interesting because we wrestle with, well, where was he in this? What was his ideals? And Dickinson himself even knows that this is going to be the point in which he loses his popularity. And he even says, I know that I am going to sacrifice some of the popularity that I've gained, but I cannot compromise against my principles. But so he doesn't compromise his principles, but he does everything in his power to defend the country that he is now part of. That includes giving support to the troops. It includes when he resigns his commission, he joins again as a private in the militia, which was not done. A gentleman of his stature did not just shoulder a musket. He also has faces... If he had been found by the British at that point, he would have been hung as a traitor. His house here in Delaware is subject to a Tory raid in 1781. He also has his house in Philadelphia burned to the ground. Now, during this time, it's interesting because in 1781, Dickinson becomes president of Delaware, which was governor, and then during that same time, a year later, becomes president of Pennsylvania. So there's a short, brief time when Dickinson is both president of Delaware and of Pennsylvania. So after that, Dickinson continues in politics, but he becomes part of, he is the chairman of the Annapolis Convention. And what that is where we try to reorganize the Articles of Confederation so that we have an operating doctrine. Well, he realized that was not going to work. I was one of the people to really write a letter to have the Constitutional Convention, which came about, of course, in 1787. And Dickinson was a Delaware representative there, as well as a signer of the U.S. Constitution for Delaware.
Is part of the reason why maybe we don't hear as much about Dickinson and these letters because of this kind of complicated relationship he had with the Declaration of Independence and the start of the Revolution, and as you mentioned, kind of losing maybe his popularity for the way he approached all that?
I think part of it is that Dickinson had a tendency not to toot his own horn in a very sad sense. Dickinson did not brag about what he did. Dickinson left no autobiography of his own. And he even says that I only have daughters. And so he doesn't really try to claim his space really in the pantheon of what you think of as founding fathers. Yet Dickinson, Thomas Jefferson at his death, calls him one of the great worthies of the Revolution. So Dickinson had such a lasting impact on us, but because of the assassination of his character during the Declaration of Independence, that continued on. He dies in 1808, and after that, no one really writes as much about him, and so he just kind of fades from history because of that.
So, Doug, with that in mind, the state is taking some great pains to mark this anniversary and perhaps bring a little bit more light on to John Dickinson. Tell us a little bit about what the state is doing, starting with a website you've created, right?
Yeah, exactly. My boss, the Secretary of State, Jeff Bullock, really decided that this was an opportunity for us in the Department of State, which oversees the state's museums and the John Dickinson Plantation here south of Dover, to bring Dickinson to life for people and to highlight his contributions, not only to Delaware's history, but to the history of the American Revolution, the history of our early republic, again, the drafting of the U.S. Constitution, all of these things that people don't necessarily know the role he played in them. One of the things we decided to do to make that a reality was to sort of compile a crash course, if you will, on John Dickinson for people inside Delaware and outside Delaware and obviously all over the world. The website's de.gov/John Dickinson. And there we've compiled sort of a history of who he was, some of his biographical information. We compiled some really good scholarship about the Letters from a Pennsylvania Farmer, which is the 250th anniversary that we are marking, the publication of those in the winter of 1767-68. And those letters, again, were key to really coalescing the cause of the colonists at a time when the British were ratcheting up their exploitation of the colonies. So just putting that into context, putting some of that scholarship out there in a really digestible format, and coupling that with a series of special events, both here at the Dickinson Plantation in Dover, other sites that the state administers. We had a wonderful production of dramatized debate between Thomas Jefferson and John Dickinson over the question of independence. We staged that at the old State House on the Green here in Dover. We'll be having some programming that involves the Delaware Public Archives and some of the resources that they have related to the history and life of John Dickinson. University of Delaware, their library has put on display a very old, not an original, but a very old printing of the Letters from a Pennsylvania Farmer. So you can sort of see what the colonists and the people that came immediately after the colonial period would have been reading about John Dickinson. So a lot of great stuff that will culminate with the annual marking of Dickinson's death at the cemetery where he's buried, the Wilmington Friends Cemetery in the city of Wilmington.
I'll leave you both with this question. I'll start with you, Doug. What are you hoping people come away with from all these events and the website and this attempt to kind of, you know, give Dickinson a little bit more light?
Sure. I think that what we'd really like people to come away with is just more of an appreciation for the role that this man who lived here in Delaware, called our state home, was proud to be a Delawarean. The significance that he played in our shared history, and hoping that people can be able to learn a little bit more about that, engage with that history, and come away with a deeper connection to this shared past that we all have.
Bertie, how about you? What do you hope people take away from this celebration of Dickinson and these events and this website?
I agree with everything that Doug just said. I think that's very important. I think it's important for people to realize who John Dickinson was and really to understand he was his different views, and he's very nuanced in a sense, character from history. That way you get a chance to see who John Dickinson was by his actions and by his words instead of perhaps something like the play 1776 or the documentary John Adams. Maybe we should think about John Dickinson from his own words and his own actions than from how other people saw him.
Thanks to John Dickinson Plantation Historic Interpreter Verdi Lee and Doug Dennison from the Department of State for joining us on this month's History Matters, produced in conjunction with the Delaware Historical Society. And stay with us. We wrap up The Green with Enlighten Me and look at some unique holiday gift ideas made by local artisans here in the First State. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Last weekend, Small Business Saturday highlighted the importance of supporting local stores as you do your holiday shopping. But there's another reason to shop local. Many local stores and local artisans offer unique gifts for that family member or friend that's hard to buy for, or that's someone you want to give something a little out of the ordinary or something special. To help you get an idea of what's out there locally, contributor Larry Nagengast put on his Santa's hat and went out in search of some folks here in the First State that provide a little something different to put under the tree. What he found is available in his piece, available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And we sat down with Larry earlier this week to talk more about it.
You specifically, in your piece, focused on a handful of artisans. But there are a bevy of these folks out there creating their own businesses. And they really do kind of run the gamut, don't they, in what they offer and their backstories.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the people I talked to for this story include an artist, a potter, a cap maker, and a perfume maker. And they've got jobs in the banking industry and as teachers. But, you know, you go a step further and look around Delaware. You've got painters, photographers, jewelry makers, sculptors, woodworkers and carvers, soap makers, fabric artists. I mean, there's just an incredible diversity of artistic talent in the state.
And often you see these folks peddling their wares at everything from small church craft fairs to big arts festivals like the Brandywine Festival for the Arts in Wilmington. But nowadays, they're just as easy to find online, and I guess that does make them a little bit more available for this time of year, the holiday shopping time of year.
Well, let's put it this way. There, plenty of them are available, and their wares are available online. But, yeah, you know, I mean, you do have to know what you're looking for and where to go to find them. If you don't know the business's name, you may have a little bit of difficulty tracking down, the right item, what you're specifically looking for. Even so, I mean, many of these artists and crafters have their own websites. Some of them rely on Facebook business pages. Others sell through Etsy, the popular e-commerce website. You know, and there are a couple of reasons for the growth of online retailing. I mean, the number of craft shows is limited, and you can only be at one of them at a time, and there's usually a vendor fee that you've got to pay to set up your table. And, you know, and as far as the retail outlets go, it's not easy to persuade a small business owner to give up valuable shelf space to an unknown artist or crafter if the rest of your inventory is selling reasonably well. And, you know, besides the craft show, you know, there are other good places to look for local work. Places like Belfont Arts and some of the other smaller galleries in the area, and at the museum shops like those at the Delaware Art Museum and the Delaware Contemporary. Of course, you know, one other point to make about the craft shows, they are, for many people, the first stop for holiday shopping. I mean, that's always been part of the appeal for the Brandywine Festival of the Arts, which is always the weekend after Labor Day. All the people that I interviewed this year for this article did exhibit at the Brandywine Festival of the Arts. Now, lots of festival goers don't decide what to buy on the spot, and they don't want to carry larger items around while they're shopping at a festival. So they talk to the vendors, they take pictures of their work, they collect business cards, and then they place their orders from the comfort of their home. Now, for an artist, a successful show is measured not only by sales volume, but also by the follow-up business that they can generate.
So let's start talking about some of the folks that you talked to for your piece. And up first is First State Caps, the brainchild of teacher Eric Lewis. And he's relatively new to this game, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Eric just got started this year, and he's hoping to create a second income stream by capitalizing, on something that you see most every day, a baseball cap. And what makes his caps unique are the images that are embroidered on them, symbols that have special meaning to Delaware. A blue hen, a peach blossom, a horseshoe crab, or a ladybug.
And so he is definitely targeting a very local audience with his cap. And a lot of these vendors do tend to, you know, have a very specific audience they're looking for. And he does in this case, obviously.
Yeah, you're certainly right about that. I mean, the caps are a fun and practical way to show your fondness for the First State. They can be a great conversation starter. And most importantly, for a new business, a baseball cap is something that almost everyone can use.
Also fairly new is Brandywine Botanicals, offering perfume, which I imagine is not an easy business to get going on your own. How did this get started?
Well, again, Robin Kilkowski, who has worked in the banking and financial services industry for years, has long had an interest in fragrances, and she decided a couple of years ago to try making some of these on her own. She liked experimenting with different scents, and she decided early this year to turn her hobby into a home-based business. She uses all natural ingredients, and there's a lot of trial and error to her work. She's come up with some blends, and she hasn't liked them at first, and she let them sit in a vial for a little while longer and took a sniff a couple of weeks later and said, hey, this is really good, and she's kept it going. Other times she's tried and, you know, hasn't really liked it at all and scrapped it. But she's doing reasonably well with it. She likes her product, certainly. That's tough, of course, for the buyer to use your sense of smell on a laptop or a smartphone. But, you know, you can order sample kits from the Brandywine Botanicals website, and then you can decide which fragrances you like best. This is really interesting about Robin. She says sometimes it's easier for her to deliver your order in person rather than pack it up and take it to the post office. So you could get door-to-door delivery, as it were, from it for an online order.
And that is the kind of personal touch that a lot of these businesses can add that you're not going to get elsewhere. Let's talk about What She Said Pottery, which kind of puts a fun spin on the old-fashioned coffee mug. Tell us a little bit about this business.
Okay, well, again, now, Lindsay Ostafy, she's also a teacher at the Cab Calloway School of the Arts. And she's a potter who's definitely got an attitude. I mean, you know, you ask her to describe her work, and she'll admit that it's snarky. You know, smart alecky phrases with a feminist bent. Some people love her choice of words. Others are a little bit less kind. I mean, she's seen couples get into arguments while checking out her work. You know, no matter what you think, though, chances are you've got a friend who will get a kick out of her sass.
And finally, we have Nicole Christiana Studios, which offers a wide range of original art. That's, I guess, maybe more of a traditional artisan that you see at some of these festivals and fairs.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, original artwork and prints. Yeah, that's the standard fare at a lot of these fairs. But, you know, Nicole Logan, she is one of my favorites. I met her a couple of years ago when she was painting a small mural on the wall of one of the shops in Bellefont as part of a town beautification project. You know, she specializes in these whimsical paintings of animals that are playful enough for kids to enjoy and sufficiently detailed for sophisticated adults to want to hang in their living rooms. And now, Nicole works full-time for Bank of America, but she still spends some 20 hours a week painting and managing her business. Now, for a close-up of her work, you could head over to the Grand Opera House in Wilmington in December, where she's the featured artist at the Main Stage Gallery this month.
And the one thing that these artisans seem to have in common, and we've kind of maybe you know, alluded to it earlier, is that their products are unique and a lot of times handmade, handcrafted. So in a lot of ways, you are, if you're looking for a different type of gift, you're getting something that's really special. As you're looking for that maybe hard-to-buy person.
Well, absolutely. The great thing about working with the local crafters and choosing their work is that it is somewhat special. It's different. It's not mass-produced in by any sense of the word. And, you know, it's created by someone who might be your neighbor, might be your friend, or a friend of a friend. You know, there's a closeness about being able to buy something from one of our local artists. And, you know, what better time to support the artists and to support local businesses by purchasing some of your holiday gifts from these artisans.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for enlightening us this week. Again, you can find his piece on these local artisans and their products right now at DelawarePublic.org. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to everyone who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nagengast, Delaware Public Media's Nick Schellino, and Sarah Mueller. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.